Episode 101, baby. It's Friday, August 9th, 2018. Welcome to episode 101. Yes! Of Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Today, Rashida Tlaib. Did I get that right, Sean?
I guess.
There you go. A Palestinian American from Detroit will become the first Muslim woman to ever be elected to Congress. And she's also a Democratic Socialist. Meanwhile, in the halls of the bubble machine, Politico asks, is socialism dead? Well, that's what six-figure pundits are saying. We'll talk about that. And we got to talk about New York Times epic New York Times Sunday, New York Times Magazine, Losing Earth by Nathaniel Rich. As California battles the largest fires in the state history, an additional 17 fires continue to burn. California is also using prison labor to help these fires. Is that a peek into our dystopian future? Yep. And put this in the what the f- are you thinking file. President of AFL-CIO Richard Trumka offers what seems like qualified support for Trump's trade policy and would not rule out supporting Trump in 2020 when asked. All right. We'll talk a little bit of what our own Pennsylvania's own John Meyerson had to say about that. Trump goes off the rails in Wilkes-Barre. Goes after immigrants, goes after Casey, goes after the media. You've probably seen the clips, but it's crazy. And it leads to the nice little side stories about QAnon and PA's Nazi sanctuary city up in the north. Some of the biggest winners of the Trump tax break are, surprise, surprise, corporate CEOs who cashed in big on stock buybacks. Closer to home in Pennsylvania, Koch Brothers, Americans for Prosperity, gets ready to back Scott Wagner. We told you, we warned you, we told you the money was going to begin rolling in as the election got closer. Labor Day is going to be the marker, folks. Scott Wagner flip-flops on climate change, or does he? He now acknowledges that it's caused by greenhouse gases. I want to see the exact proof. I don't want to see, like, it's caused by humans, because he's already says it's caused by humans. Humans because they have warm bodies. I want to see him say the words. Burning fossil fuels. We'll see. Tom Wolf says that Pennsylvania is not ready for recreational marijuana, even though two-thirds of Pennsylvanians want it, and a good chunk of those folks are stoned right now, probably. The first Pennsylvania statewide investigation into the abuses of Catholic priests is expected to be released any day now. It could have been released as early as August 8th. That may be delayed, if you believe some sectors, but that report coming out will look at allegations against more than 300 priests in six dioceses, covering more than 1.7 million parishioners. That comes after Attorney General Josh Shapiro led an 18-month-long investigation. And in today's last call, it's probably a quick one, folks, because I got a dog. I should say I got a puppy, which means more time than a dog. But back from vacation, obviously. We talk a little bit about that. Raging Chicken, this is a big announcement. We'll be going to Netroots Nation in 2019. Why? Because it's coming to Philly. The last time Sean and I were at Netroots Nation was up in Providence, Rhode Island. I took us the long way to get there, if you remember. It took freaking forever. We'll get into that. And the next Free Range podcast is on the horizon. All right, Colleen and I are going to talk this week about just when the next release will come. Remember, everybody, tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Rick just got back from Alaska and got to see the glaciers, or lack thereof. But tune into him at 7 p.m. Eastern on Free Speech TV. You can go to watch the show live at freespeech.org or tune into the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. Well, huge shout out to our newest member. Thank you, Ron. Ron came in this week and became a member at the $5 a month level. So if you want to be like Ron and you want to support a progressive future, we need the progressive media. You can support it. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month, just like Ron did. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. Not ready to become a member? No problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the big blue donate button on the right sidebar, and donate whatever you want. $100? Oh, sure. Okay, we'll take it. The 2018 midterm election's right around the corner, and now we know the Koch brothers are prepared to dump their change right here in Pennsylvania. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is become a member of Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/rcpress. There we have it, Sean, man. Kind of welcome back, man. Welcome back. It's, been a while since I've been on vacation, and last week I just kind of like went how you been?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, you know, I'm kind of rested. It was kind of like a vacation. Went to see my folks up in Utica, New York, and they've got a little place up on one of the lakes in the Adirondacks, and so did a bunch of that. And be honest with you, is like I think we had been kind of traveled out. By the end of the vacation, we were all pretty exhausted. So it was actually kind of good to come back, and now all eyes towards the school year starting to do school supplies and all that stuff. And just to make everything go much, much more smoothly, we got a puppy. So so that's my life right now.
Perfect for the school starts, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect timing, right?
At least the weather's going to be getting nice this weekend. It's going to be like in the upper 70s, low 80s. Next 15 days. So I'm looking forward to maybe taking my air conditioner out.
Oh,
so.
Man. Well, that's actually good to hear. I haven't checked the weather lately. I've been just like dealing with the gruel or the freaking pea soup that's out there now.
Yeah.
Oh, so man. So a lot has obviously happened since we were last on air. And there's no way we're going to get to every of it. We're not going to do a summary of everything. So we're just going to get right into it. I mean, I think we'd start like right current events, not yesterday, Tuesday. We had primaries across the country, not everywhere, but there were some kind of key ones in there. And, everyone.
Socialism died.
Yeah, and socialism died. So I guess it's, back to free market capitalism, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's one or two Ocasio-Cortez backed candidates won, and socialism is dead.
Yep.
It's dead. Time to give up. You know, screw the fact that DSA is now up over 48,000 members.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess it's too bad that all those folks that are putting all their energy and kind of building movements and building stuff on the ground in all the cities and have actually kind of running candidates at local levels for the first ever time. And one of the most rapidly growing aspects of the left is now going to have to basically –
pack up its bags and go back and leave and go never
back
have
to,
it.
Yeah, go back to despair and low wages and kind of like eternal debt future, all because Politico says so.
Yes. The tiger on the Potomac, as Charlie Pierce calls it.
God. Yeah, so there you go. So, yeah, so talk a little about this article, man.
I actually have not read it.
Oh, God. Great.
I'm going to
dish to Sean for the article that he put on the agenda for today, but he hasn't read it.
I didn't read it because the hot take is down goes socialism.
Down goes socialism.
And really, like, I don't need to waste 10 minutes of my life looking into some of the shitty hot takes that have been coming out over the past few days on this. But basically, like, the gist of it starts off, the first paragraph is that Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders' movements are now losing steam because none of the candidates, or very few of their candidates, won over the weekend. They expected, right? She endorsed a 33-year-old candidate to run for governor in Michigan, Abdul Al-Sayed, and he lost. So therefore, this first time candidate, since his first time candidate lost his run for governor at 33, the movement's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
But
we did have Rashida Tlaib win, and she is a DSA member out of Detroit, and she will be the first. She's a Palestinian American, and she'll become the first Muslim woman ever elected to Congress. And once that happens,
yeah, exactly. So everybody, so just prepare yourself, right? For all the folks who've been kind of like, you know, building this movement and been getting excited and, you know, saw the win by Ocasio-Cortez and it just kind of put like wind in the sails.
And these are like centrist Democrats that are trying to take the winds out of these sails.
Right, that's exactly. So let's be really clear what's happening here, right? So let me just read you a couple little segments from the political article. I just get used to this kind of language, okay? And then I just wanted to break it down a little bit for you. So it's like here. So Tuesday night's largely Midwest primaries produced a near shutout for the anti-establishment left. Ocasio-Cortez partnered with Bernie Sanders to make a series of splashy endorsements that in the end failed to clinch victories. And two leftist upstarts hoping to emulate Ocasio-Cortez and defeat longtime Democratic incumbents fell far short. Right. So that's not the lead paragraph. That's the second paragraph in. But this is the kind of language that you're going to start to see by these kind of centrist Democrat influenced rags.
Yes, yeah. Because Politico right. is the ever progressive newspaper in the nation.
Well, but let's remember kind of what this is. What also we're going to hear this from.
This is what the insiders are telling themselves.
Right. But look,
like, hey guys, they didn't win. So right. we're going to be insulating ourselves in our bubble, our trenches that much more because they lost and
right.
And we're not going to pay attention to the real needs of people.
No. And I say, you know, and I say to everyone on the left, right, who may feel like a little despair after that kind of headline or something like that, do not. This is the best news you could possibly want, right? Because basically what these people are saying is like, oh, look, we were still right all along. We don't need to do anything. We're going to keep on thinking about using the word opportunity as a way to kind of solve all of our electoral problems, right? But what they're basically doing, the measurement that Politico and these other centrists are using, are basically saying, okay, did they win? Did they win this particular primary, right? And if they win, uh-oh, we got to worry about it. And if they lose, it's the end. Right. When
boom.
Right.
Movement implodes, goes away.
Right. And let's not forget that not long ago we were talking about how, you know, the kind of opportunity 2020 people got together. Right. You know, the centrist Democrats who have no plan, they got together to try to figure out what to do. And they still came away with nothing. Those folks were basically saying that, OK, Ocasio-Cortez's win might have been important, but that's, you know, Queens. Right. That's New York City. That's not the Midwest.
And that was the Bronx.
Right. That was the Bronx, Queens and Bronx. Right. And so that was there might play well there, but not back up in the Midwest. And that's the line that we're going to get from Democrats here. So when they look at this, it's helping to reinforce their own movement. However, what we always have to keep our eyes on is actually what is actually happening on the ground and the kind of pressure these movements are bringing forward. So win or lose, right? And anybody who's actually done any organizational politics for a long period of time will tell you this. This is about a process of moving the ball, right? Of fundamentally changing what counts as politics, right? What Sean would always talk about, moving the Overton window, right? And that is happening. It's happening left and right, and these people are just falling all over themselves looking for some hope that they can just keep their big paychecks from Wall Street, right, and ignore the rest of us, and that is basically over.
Yeah. So. And also, like, someone wants to make the argument that, you know, the people like this woman, Tlaib, who is replacing John Conyers, see, like, this – they're saying, like, well – this is just the districts becoming the representation of their constituents, which is moving further to the left. Well, yeah, that's the point.
That's the point we've been making.
Like, this, like, you're trying to downplay, like yes, like, you know, like, for instance, in Pennsylvania, Dom and Paul Costa.
There you go.
Were completely conservative compared to the districts that they represented and were never challenged. And then they were challenged and lost.
Right.
Like, that's how politics gets moved to the left.
Right. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly
and
it.
It's like these are people who are running on a platform where having healthcare and having, you know, access to free public higher education and having a $15 an hour minimum wage, which is all something all these centrists are against, is like basic human rights and dignity living in one of the richest countries in the world.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, another thing I guess we forgot to mention, the Prop A in Missouri that went down, the right to work law that went down by a 2/3 vote. I mean, yep. You look at it when people have the choice of voting on their own economics betterment in a open and free democracy, they will always choose that mm-hmm. when it's on the ballot.
Yep. Well, and I have to say, I'll say one more thing about this, you know, about the this political article. So one of the things that Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie put a lot kind of into was this race in Kansas's 3rd congressional district, right? And they put their money behind and time and everything behind Brent Welder, right? And Brent Welder kind of like, you know, basically Bernie platform, right? And I believe he was he a Bernie staffer?
I'm not sure.
Right? Yeah. He's a former Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign staffer, and he hoped to kind of bring this to Kansas's 3rd district. Right now, he lost. Right. And what was really interesting about this race, though, is that, you know, he's running against kind of Charisse Davids. Right. Charisse Davids was a lesbian, Native American, professional mixed martial arts fighter. Right. She was a former Obama White House fellow. And there was a big back and forth about this, about why Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie were not going to be willing to back Charisse Davids instead of Welder. And, you know, it kind of came down to a decision that they made. But the fact is that this primary, right, in Kansas's 3rd district, right, congressional district, was one of the most vibrant and interesting kind of debates and campaigns that was out there. And that would not have been possible. We would have not even been paying attention to what was going on there, right? Had there not had energy kind of come into politics. So in my mind, right, not only do we have like what we see in the kind of like this kind of socialist kind of like argument being pushed there, we see people start talking about Medicare for all. Not only that, we see kind of women getting involved at historic levels because of the Women's March and the women's movement in the face of Trump. We see an activation of politics and a re-energizing of kind of grassroots politics regardless. So in my mind, this is a kind of a win-win stuff. The fact is that with Welder in the race and with Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders putting their names behind that race, they couldn't write off the economic issues, right? The Democratic establishment could not write off the economic issues. They had to be part of the conversation.
And
that's huge.
I was able to see Jeff Weaver speak a couple weeks ago while we were away.
Yeah.
Jeff Weaver is Bernie Sanders' top campaign person. And he said, yeah, let's duke it out in the primaries.
Yep.
I am all for primaries because you fight out your arguments there.
Yep. And that's a good deal. Good deal. Good deal. Good deal. So, you know, again, there's a lot to be, you know, if we keep your eyes, you know, this is what we've been trying to do with Raging Chicken ever since we started, right, 7 years ago. The whole idea is that you keep your eyes on the social movements and not just on electoral outcomes, right? The fact is that it's not a zero-sum game when you think about politics for the long haul, not simply one particular electoral cycle, right? And that's what DSA and other socialists and other leftists and women and kind of feminists kind of across the country, right, and the kind of the movements coming out of Black Lives Matter, this is what all these groups have been pushing, right? Have been pushing for that long-term solution, not just electoral victories. So, yes, it's easy for Politico and these other places to cover the horse race, right? But the more interesting stuff, what's always been more interesting, historically, the only thing that's ever moved things have been social movements. And that is where the energy is right now. So even if you get a centrist Democrat basically into office right now, those movements are going to be putting so much pressure upon those candidates, right, to keep them on the right path. So, hey, man, ace is high in my book.
Yep.
Cool. So now I know you haven't had a chance to see this yet, but I mean, look, if we look at The Losing Earth by Nathaniel Rich, right? Second time in the history of the New York Times Magazine. This was published last week. It was released earlier in the week online. And I think I told you, it's like, you know, I wanted to read it. I was just getting all this play, wanted to read it. And I was like, man, this is taking me so long to get through. My reading has slowed down. But the thing was, like, you know, it's about 100 pages long if you actually put it in standard pages. It's a really substantial piece about the period of time from 1979 to 1989 when we actually had a chance to solve the issue of climate change. Right. All the science was in. Right. This is the way that kind of Nathaniel Rich actually kind of pitches the whole thing, is that the science was in, the corporations had not yet begun to kind of dump their, all their marbles in with the climate denialists. Right. They actually, their own scientists were actually saying that, nope, this confirming what was being found by independent scientists, that climate change by the burning of fossil fuels is indeed the cause of climate change. It's a remarkable story about how close and how much everybody was on the same page. It's also a story about people being unable to get the hell out of their own way and actually kind of make a decision on stuff. It's also, in my mind, a story about what happens when the broader public is not engaged systemically, like on these kind of issues, and it remains a kind of an insider's decision-making game. That's what happened in this whole story of losing Earth. Now, the one thing that a lot of criticisms of the article that came out was that Nathaniel Rich in the end basically wants to kind of – he's a little softer on the corporations and other stuff in the way that the story is told. And the end want to say, like, we all are at fault in some way because it's human nature not being able to kind of do this. If you read the thing carefully, I don't think he puts all of his arguments in that court, right? So I'm not as critical as some of the folks that are on it, but I do think Naomi Klein was dead on in her response to his piece. Is that where Nathaniel Rich basically wants to say, look, we were so close and we just couldn't, because of human nature or whatever, we couldn't make this decision, we couldn't pull the trigger, and now we're screwed, right? And now we're screwed. And that leads down a realm of despair. What Klein does, and I've always thought that she's been dead on about this, it's not that we just couldn't because we're humans. It was because, as she argues, right, in her book on climate change, right, as she argues, it was the worst possible moment in history for all the science to become clear. Because in order to do something at that point, what you were competing with was not like politicians that go, you know, everything in Nathaniel Rich piece is about Sununu coming in and kind of like messing everything up. In Naomi Klein's book, basically saying, no, this is the worst possible timing. Because it was the time of the explosion of neoliberal politics. It was right before the fall of the Berlin Wall, when we're seeing this kind of like the end of history arguments and free range capitalism kind of going wild at the same period of time. And I think that she is dead on about that. But we are in this moment, right? We are in this moment now where you can see this in the Nathaniel Rich piece, is basically predict, you know, saying that they knew then that we're going to see the kind of stuff that we see in California right now. Largest fires in history. They're out of control. People talking about fire tornadoes. They've never been seeing fire being able to behave this way because it's burning so hot and seeming like it's blowing in every direction because the fire is so big that it's creating its own wind. I mean, crap like that, man. So do check that out. And, you know, I'd be curious what people thought about it too as well, if you kind of got into some of the pieces of it. But crazy, man. Crazy, man. So that's one of my assignments for you, Sean. You got to read that.
We'll see.
No, seriously. I'm telling you, you need to.
And then, speaking about fire going on in California.
Yeah.
California, the progressive state that it is using slave labor to put these fires out, for pretty much.
That's our future.
They're using inmates. They're using juvenile inmates, and using women as well, female inmates, to put out these fires for as little as 1 to 2 hours a day. And I think we like talked about this last year at some point.
We did.
And we're going to talk about it again.
Well, it doesn't go away, right? I mean,
no, it doesn't. This is the future that we have. And it's also our criminal justice system, where once slavery was abolished, if it ever was abolished, it never grants prisoners those same rights.
No.
And this is modern day slavery.
Well, and look, it's only going to get worse, right? If you go, if you follow the worst, like, dystopic version of this, right? Not even the worst of it, because it's not the worst anymore. This is, like, what's probable, right, as one of the possibilities. We've already seen that, like, Naomi Klein talks about this. I should mention, her book is called This Changes Everything. That's the one on climate change. But she talks about this. There's this other book. I can't remember the woman's name who wrote it. It's called The Price of Thirst. Right, who talks about the way that water is being sequestered, about the building of these houses, right, over water banks, right, for the uber rich. They're already planning a future in which they know they can't get water, that they know that they are going to be in the line of the worst of the impacts of climate change, like these fires. So they're building these compounds that nobody lives in them yet, but they're preparing them, right? And they're literally got walls and gates around them to protect us from the masses, right? So that's the future. And so as people move away from this and as people run away from these fires, what's going to protect them, right? The only thing that's going to be able to protect them is that, you know, you can only bring so many, like, firefighters, like professional firefighters in, right? They've got people, right? They had to pull firefighters from Australia and New Zealand off of the car fire to send them to the what's it called? Mendocino, is that what it is?
Mendocino
fire. That's the one that's the largest in history. They had to pull it off the car fire, which killed those people, which killed so many people and destroyed so many homes, fight this other one. Simply can't have enough. You're going to run out of people to fight the flame. So how do you do that? Right? You take people who have no choice and you force them to fight fires. And that's who was it in California? The leader of the kind of incarceration nation. They're the ones that are pulling out, our future firefighters for this kind of stuff. And that's going to happen. This is just in the fire. This is going to happen when it comes to flooding. This is going to happen when it comes to, you know, kind of massive storm damage, right? Because the labor to do this stuff and the unwillingness for governments, corporations, or anything like this to pay for the impacts of climate change is going to basically, they're going to start tapping our prison labor, right? I don't see any way around it. And that's part of what we're looking. We're looking down the barrel of that, folks. And this is really serious. Again, all the more reason why there is no more time to wait for a leftist upsurge here. We need to take this politics back.
Yeah.
Crazy. Well, speaking of somebody who's not willing to take some politics back, who's still going to keep playing the middle and stand on the fence. Did you see this crap from Richard Trumka, the president of AFL-CIO this week?
I did not read into it, but I saw a couple critiques of it.
On Twitter, I assume.
And Facebook.
So Trumka, so he was at this thing, right? It was kind of this forum, but it was put on by the Christian Science Monitor. And they were talking about, Trump's trade policies. Now, look, for a long time, and Trumka comes out of steel, right? And so for a long time, the steel workers were, like, virtually the only group out there, only organization out there. And I don't mean just only labor organization. I mean any organization that was suing other countries, right, for violations of the World Trade Organization agreements, right? So violations of, like, steel dumping, of all this other stuff. And so what they argued, they've been arguing for a while, is that those countries that violate these agreements, they need to have tariffs being put on them, right? So you could see, so again, this is kind of part of where the discussion was coming. Now, of course, Trump has been putting tariffs on this. Now Trumka comes out and basically he's saying, well, you know, kind of, you know, we disagree with a bunch of other stuff, but this, yeah, he's actually right on the right track. Right on the right track when it comes to supporting these tariffs, and we need to be doing more of that. And he understands that. What got me most is when Trumka said that, like, he understands, right, what needs to be done, right? And I don't think there's any way in hell that we can say that he actually understands.
No, I think what this is doing is just Trump following his white nationalist impulses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the fact that Trumka...
This isn't Trump being an economist. This is Trump following his white nationalist policies.
Exactly. And the fact that the president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka...
Can't fucking see that?
Can't say that, right? In that kind of clarity, crazy. So this is what John Meyerson, right? He is from UFCW 1776 right here in Pennsylvania. I first saw this article because of John Meyerson's comment, okay? It kind of came up in my feed this way. And so Richard Trumka made that comment, right? And part of it, here was the deal, is that in the end he said, okay, there's a back and forth around tariffs, but then he says that he's asked, are you going to support Trump in the election in 2020 or so on? And Trumka refused to kind of say whether or not the AFL-CIO would endorse Trump. And that left a firestorm among kind of progressives in the labor movement, right? So here's John Meyerson. John Meyerson said this on Facebook. He said, quote, "I'm sorry, Richie, but the answer to the question should have been," and here's what Meyerson would have said, "while we might agree on some of Trump's trade policies, there is no way we can endorse any candidate who sows hatred and tries to divide our members by race, religion, sexual orientation, and place of birth, period. That's how you lead, damn it." Right? Thank you right there, John Meyerson, right, for saying what should have been said in response to anything about endorsement. And that blew my mind, Sean, that the response couldn't have been that clear coming from Trumka.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I should say this too as well. I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, you know, again, and I know that there's a lot of folks in the labor movement who are wanting to look at the tariffs, right, as the solution. But I think we need to remember the problem here, right, is the trade agreements, right? And not that we just need to kind of stop NAFTA and all this kind of stuff. Like, I'm totally against what has happened with NAFTA and the WTO. But again, I think when back in the 1999 and 2000, the early 2000s, before 9/11, when we had the global justice movement and there was this kind of like another world is possible movement where people were actually kind of making this question, the line was always this: we are not anti-globalization, right? In other words, we're not against, right, people being able to kind of get together and talk about global agreements. We're anti-corporate globalization. The idea that an anti-neoliberal globalization, right? The idea is that I think it would be better if we had better international agreements, ones that protected the environment, ones that protected labor rights, ones that ensured that corporations were being held accountable no matter where they went, right? That is what those agreements should have been. Right. The whole idea about putting tariffs on things, that is only mitigating the disaster that was those neoliberal economics. And the fact is, if we want to kind of talk about a progressive future, that's where we got to go. Not kind of like supporting, well, you know, maybe Trump's OK on this. No. Tariffs. OK, he's doing this tariff. But guess what? Because of the way the trade agreements are set up, right, because of the way that those are working, it's screwing over other American workers. Right. Because of those trade agreements. Right. The only way to solve this is to go global again, not to pull it back in on some freaking white nationalist pipe dream. That's something that can't actually ever happen again. The same crap that is happening at our borders right now with immigration is the same logic that drives, just as you said, Sean, that drives Trump's quote unquote trade policies. It's just a hatred of brown folk. That's really what it comes down to. Or anyone that is kind of like not going to kind of like kiss his ass.
Yeah.
But there you go. I said it. That's what I had to say. And I guess, you know, what drives me crazy, this is in the wake of what just happened in Wilkes-Barre. Right? I mean, Trump comes to Pennsylvania to, like, I don't know, freaking throw his train off the rails, get rid of the emergency brake, and take us back down into the darkest corners of his campaign.
Yeah. I mean, I did not see really much of what came out of that event.
Okay, just for everybody, just for the record, Sean is not red. He did not see.
But I mean, you know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't like, you don't have to read this stuff because you know what's going to happen. It's like, I don't need to be reminded about this. But yeah.
Why that was important, I think, just to
I think some of the more dangerous things lately is going to be the attacks on the media that he's been more vocal about.
Exactly.
That I think is like one of the because at that point it's almost like a strategy that they're using, right? And it's a strategy that Wagner's using too.
That's exactly
right. You point the media out in your crowd or at your rallies or at your town halls, and you do that as a way of intimidation.
Yes.
But someone in there might take a shot at you, might swing at you. but yep. like it singles you out. And it's I mean, it's also we're going down a really bad rabbit hole here. If we start openly attacking the media, I actually had a really funny thing. One of the reporters I knew went up there, Mysik, mm-hmm. Forgot his press credentials, his lanyard mm-hmm. for his press credentials.
Did he put on a QAnon shirt to get in?
He did not. the only press credentials he had is backups in the car, mm-hmm. in his car, came with an MSNBC lanyard. Uh-huh. And because he said like an MSNBC function like sometime last year. Where he was doing something for them, and he pulled out his like backup credentials. And he said, "Oh my God, this is how I'm going to die." Exactly. But I mean, people were saying shit to him the whole entire time, yelling at him. But the one of the observations I think we had about it, we were talking about this over a couple beers the other night. The people outside were really friendly. And everything, mm-hmm. you know, people wait in line for hours and hours, but like Trump's just whips them up while they're inside. And it's like that horde mentality, that crowd mentality, the mob mentality where you get this guy, he's just whipping these people up. And then that's when the attacks start coming.
Right.
And, one of the things, there were not many QAnon people there at the rally, but they were getting interviewed. And I don't know, this is the type of thing where you just leave them alone and just let it fizzle out, or you report on it and then gives it more traction and it grows and grows and grows. But these people are legitimately crazy.
Yeah. And it's like, look, I would go right back to what we've been saying, like ever since that you especially started covering a lot of the white nationalist stuff, is like you cover this stuff before it becomes a problem, right? If you wait until it actually becomes a physical threat, right, and a threat to a kind of like, you know, take over more sections of the Republican Party, for example, it's you've waited too long.
And like right now, this is really like a small fringe movement,
yes,
within that part of the right. And I was actually reading a really good article on BuzzFeed this week. The QAnon conspiracy theories actually was started by left. Leaning like not like left like progressives or stuff like that, but like leftist trolls mm-hmm. in the anonymous world, and they're pretty much just like bragging like we got these fucking normies and like boomers all believe in this shit, like, and they're kind of like in their own like forums just like laughing at like wow, like this like insane conspiracy theory that no one would believe is actually like going mainstream. And like it's scary that like there's like a like these fucking baby boomers are eating this shit up and believing it.
Well, it's like that, you know. Again, we've talked about this extensively on the podcast, and you know, we're not alone in this. That you know, there's a section of the population, right, that has authoritarian like tendencies. Right off,
like, yeah, you just got they've existed for thousands of years,
right?
Like these people have existed like 25-30% of these, like whatever.
Right. People that, and by authoritarian tendencies, just so everybody's clear, like once again, not just people that who are the authoritarian like dictator thing, but people who look to the leader, right, and will follow what the leader says, right? Even if it means that, you know, from day one to day two, you've switched your position 180 degrees, right? If the leader has said so, you're willing to follow, as long as that's a strong leader, as all this other kinds of, you know, stuff that goes into that kind of personality trait. The point is that what's different now is not that these people are new, is that there's the right wing has, you know, and the Republican Party has, you know, nurtured a way of activating these people and yes. bringing them together out of their little holes in their basements and bringing them into what they perceive of as a movement, even though it's freaking nuts.
And like, you know, we documented here, we caught the GOP red-handed gathering signatures at a 3% rally that hosted Christian Yingling, who was, you know, there's video of him in that PBS Frontline documentary on Charlottesville there in military garb. Like, we got these, like, we saw these, the Republican, they're bringing them in with open arms.
Right.
and they're bringing them in because they're voters. They're going to vote for them regardless. And then that's just going to, and then eventually they're going to consume the party. And we're watching that right now in real time.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's one part of it. But the other thing is, like, I don't know, this kind of connects in. It just kind of reminds me why this stuff is important, is that, yes, you have the QAnon focus. And I just actually thought that was kind of interesting to see. It wasn't, again, it's not as if everyone there or half the people that went to Wilkes-Barre. Well, two things I want to say about this. It is true that not half the people that went there are like QAnon or something like that, right? So even though they did get coverage.
It was a handful.
Right. It was a handful. But it was even more than a handful, right? Because they had the shirts on, right? They had signs and all this other kinds of stuff. So there was enough of them there. So it's that group, right, exists within this larger group. And if you watch that rally, if you watch that, you know, from start to finish, the Trump rally in Wilkes-Barre, it wasn't just the QAnon people that were going off the rails with Trump. It was everybody in that crowd.
Yeah.
Right. That's the problem, is that the QAnon, the 3%ers, like the right wing militia, the neo-Nazis, the Klan folks. And this is what there was this other piece in The Washington Post this week, too, as well, about Ulysses, Pennsylvania, about has become basically the sanctuary city for Nazis, right, up in the kind of northern border of Pennsylvania.
Potter County.
Right. And then this is exactly the same kind of principle. The fact that these folks are coming out of the woodwork now and are making challenges to kind of what we consider normal more than ever before. So this is dangerous shit.
Yes. And the thing about like these people up at the Ulysses, the Nazi people. So the weekend before the 2016 election, Art Jones from the National Socialist Movement held a rally on the Capitol steps in Harrisburg. Roxbury and a bunch of other people were there. There was neo-fascist organizations interviewing these people from Italy and stuff like that. You could tell there were French reporters there. There were some local press there. No local media was there. It was a weekend thing. And God forbid if the media does anything on the weekends anymore. But Roxbury filmed Art Jones speaking there. A bunch of other people did. This group is called the National Socialist Movement, NSM. And they, one of the things that did not get touched upon in this, the NSM concocted a plot to blow up a air tank filled with bombs and shrapnel right in the middle of the Antifa counter-protest that was going on across the street of the Capitol. These are the same people that were featured in this latest story from Washington Post and the Philly Inquirer and all.
There you go.
This is the people that the right is pandering to. Burnside was there, that was featured in the story. Art Jones is there, who's now running for Congress out in Illinois. There are other people from all across the country that were there. There was maybe like 50 of them there and like 300 counter protesters, anti-fascist, and people like the community were there counter protesting them. And they, you know, across the street from the Capitol, where it's like that stone circle in the middle of the road, they were planning to set off a bomb right there.
God.
Thankfully, the bomb was inert. The FBI was able to, I guess, they probably have people inside of this group. You would think they do, but they were able to arrest these people before the action even happened.
There you go. There you go. Keystone State, Sean.
What? Yeah.
The Keystone State. The Keystone. Yep. Crazy. But there you have it. Right here in Pennsylvania, everybody. Yeah. That just gets me. It's got my brain to turn in. So, all right. So, last thing before we take a break, quick stuff on the Trump tax cuts. So if you ever wanted to see what the results are of Republican policy, right? So I shouldn't even call them the Trump tax cuts, because let's be clear. These are the tax cuts that were proposed that came from Paul Ryan, right? And Mitch McConnell, the Republican Congress, right? These are the things that they wanted. This is the primary reason why they will tolerate any of the garbage that Trump does, because they're going to get this stuff, right? So here's just an example. Since his tax cuts were enacted, right, you know, the big promise that all of this is good for all of us, all the money is going way, way, way to the top. So here's just some rundown. Safra Katz is the CEO of Oracle Corporation, right? Katz sold $250 million worth of shares from her company, the largest executive payday of the year. $250 million for selling back stock. Product development head Thomas Kurian sold $85 million, and the sales came after the company announced a $12 billion share repurchase. So let's just see. This stuff used to be illegal, right, until this was deregulated. Right. The idea is that there's a tax cut that's going to come in, right, for this. So all these CEOs are holding all these shares. Right. And they're just going to hold on to them. And now there's this enormous tax cut so that they won't get taxed on all this stuff. And then the company says, hey, we're going to boost our stock price and we're going to buy back our own stock. Right. So now these CEOs unload the stock that they've been holding. Right. Don't have to pay a whole lot of tax on it anymore. Right. And cash in big time. Right. MasterCard CEO AJ Banga sold $44.4 million in stock in May. That was the largest single cash out by an executive of the company in at least 10 years. The company also announced that came after the company announced a $4 billion buyback of its own stock. And 2 days after Eastman Chemical announced they would purchase $2 billion of its own stock back, CEO Mark Costa sold 55,000 shares for $5.4 million. These are the people who are benefiting. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Apple, right? Did you see this, Sean? Apple became the first $1 trillion company in history.
Yep.
Right? These are the people who are benefiting, right? And when Apple becomes the first $1 trillion company in history, do you think they're actually going to the factories that are producing this stuff and giving those workers in China, right, and other places across the world, giving them a livable wage? No. Right? Remember, do you think all those people in those Apple stores are now suddenly going to be making $155,000 a year or something like that? No. This is going to the people at the very top. This is 1% economy at its worst.
Not even 1%. This is like 0.1% or 0.01%.
Good point.
Yeah.
So there you have it, folks. That's my happy news to close out this segment. Anything else for before we head to a break, Sean?
No, I don't have anything.
I think we got it. All right. We'll keep it rolling along, just like Sean likes, right? So here we go.
Keep it rolling.
Yeah, exactly. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, where I remind you that if you want to support this podcast, if you want to support the work of Raging Chicken, the ground, I should also say, I forgot to mention this at the onset. If there's any students out there, college students in particular, who are interested in doing activist media, right here with Raging Chicken Press, last year, if you recall, we had our first ever student fellow, Justin Schweitzer was our first ever student fellow, did some great work for us, and we're looking to bring someone else aboard this fall, maybe even two, depending on what schedules are, maybe one the fall, one in the spring. But if you are interested, shoot me an email at editor@ragingchickenpress.org. That's editor@ragingchickenpress.org, and let me know that you're interested. We'd love to bring on some student fellows, right? And all of you out there who are listening to this podcast, who love to read Raging Chicken Press, love to follow Sean on Twitter and on Facebook for all the trouble he gets in. Well, you can support this kind of activist media by going to patreon.com/rcpress and become a member today. Again, double thanks goes to Ron, our newest member who joined at the $5 a month level. We'd like to welcome you as a member of Raging Chicken Press today too as well. Support activist media right here, homegrown in Pennsylvania. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this quick break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day 53 construction tradesmen were killed in a fire at the Titan II ICBM launch complex near Searcy, Arkansas. It is considered one of the worst industrial accidents at a U.S. nuclear weapons facility. The complex was one of four sites containing Titan II missiles. Each missile weighed 340,000 pounds, measuring 103 feet in length and 10 feet in diameter. President Johnson had just committed more troops to the Vietnam War. The Air Force had hoped to strengthen the silo against a possible Soviet attack. They had contracted with Peter Kiewit and Son of Colorado to bring in electricians, carpenters, millwrights, painters, and pipe fitters for a number of tasks. Crews worked to shore up the silo, improve the blast doors, adjust hydraulics, and install emergency lighting. 52 of the 55 workers on all 9 levels of the silo were almost immediately asphyxiated when it suddenly filled with smoke and heat. The Air Force determined a welder on level 2 had accidentally pierced a high-pressure hydraulic line, igniting the fire. Investigators also concluded that the silo lacked adequate ventilation, alternative exits, and independent power sources. The contractor was held responsible for numerous safety violations, contributing to unsafe work conditions. The welder was found drowned in hydraulic fluid. 2 survivors suffered burns and smoke inhalation. They contested the Air Force's findings. One worker insisted no one had been welding on level 2. The other survivor stated he saw flames burst from the diesel engine just before the power went out. Both men insisted the fire started from below. By 1981, 2 more deadly accidents involving Titan II missiles would prompt President Reagan to order their deactivation.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm here, as always, with Sean Kitchen, our muckraker in chief. And Sean, closer to home here, it looks like the Koch brothers are getting stoked for the 2018 midterm elections and gubernatorial election right here in Pennsylvania.
Yes, the Koch brothers are announcing that they will, Americans for Prosperity will get the full backing of Scott Wagner. No surprise there. Last year, they knocked on like 130,000 doors, or 2016, they did that to defeat Katie McGinty, and they're looking to do the same again this year. So elections have consequences, people.
Here comes the Kochs, just yes. Like we told you they would.
Right? And this is like the second Koch brother group. The first one's Matt Breer's organization that's getting involved with the campaign. So
there you have it, man. There you have it.
Nothing really to elaborate on that.
Nope. I mean, I guess go read about ALEC. If you still haven't got caught up to speed on that, go read about Americans for Prosperity. Go read about the Koch brothers if you want to understand that, or keep on listening to Raging Chicken Press's Out the Coop podcast or reading stuff. We've been talking about this for ages. They've been like funneling tons of money. They generally stayed out of the presidential election for the most part, but now they're putting all their eggs in the state basket. And we happen to be one of the key, I don't know, baskets that they want to put their eggs into, I guess.
Yeah.
So crazy. So you got to tell me about this. So is it true that Scott Wagner now does not believe? Well, let's hear what Scott Wagner originally said. Right. First, Scott Wagner told us that
I'm smart enough to, you know, form my own opinions.
Right. That was the statement that he made. And then this is how he described global warming. Or I should say global warming, the cause of global warming.
The Earth moves closer to the sun every year. We have more people. You know, humans have warm bodies. So is heat coming off? We're just going through a lot of change. But I think we are, as a society, doing the best we can.
Okay. So now that comes. Now, remember, that's important because that was the statement that that I think there was like an 18-year-old who asked him about. A couple weeks ago.
Like, so he made that statement originally back in 2017,
right,
in front of natural gas executives at a conference.
Right.
So
and then he was called to task for that, and then that became a huge issue, right? And now supposedly they're changing things up a little bit. What's going on here?
Well, after two or three weeks of really bad press on this issue. Somehow, I don't know. I don't know why it got so much attention, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Wagner has flip-flopped on the issue. Katie Meyer for WITF reports, former York County Senator Scott Wagner and running mate Jeff Bartos have both acknowledged the scientific consensus that the rapid warming is caused by man-made greenhouse gas emissions. In the past, Wagner received flack for making untrue statements about scientific climate change in the early days of his campaign. After noting, I haven't been in a science class for a long time, he hypothesized the Earth moves closer to the sun every year. And, you know, he was called to task on this at a town hall and, you know, decided to call someone young and naive. And he pivoted again. Well, so first of all, he issued a really bad non-apology.
Mm-hmm.
At the latest town hall, it was early in the afternoon, so it was probably right after he ate and didn't have a sugar spike at the time.
all the blood went to his stomach, so he was like a little lightheaded.
He's probably a little bit clear minded.
Clear minded, empty headed, you mean?
But you know, he pretty much acknowledges, but then he went into saying, you know, we run a fleet of diesel trucks, and if you were to put a white tail on the tailpipe of these diesel trucks, you will see there would be no emissions coming out of it. It will not be black, which is, you know, diesel is pretty freaking bad.
Right.
I mean, it's more efficient burning. You get more energy out of it, but still a bad thing. And then he wanted to continue about Harrisburg releasing sewage into the Susquehanna with the recent rainstorms that happened, which is an infrastructure problem.
Crazy, 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 man. Crazy.
So I yeah.
There you have it, man. And then what he said, you know, basically he's trying to switch the whole tone by basically saying, okay, yeah, okay, we acknowledge.
And then he also said that we shouldn't be funding.
Exactly.
We shouldn't be funding renewable resources because look what happened with Solyndra.
Right. And he's saying it's not realistic to actually have clean energy. And both he and Bartos, who he's running with, right, saying that the free market will yield cleaner solutions because they've done so well so far. Right. I mean, this is kind of where
yes,
we're going.
I mean, just change the light bulbs to LED lights in your house. And
yep. And then you're all done. So there you go. This is Wagner's kind of like, yeah, okay, humans, yeah, maybe they cause it for maybe it is because of fossil fuels. But, you know, we don't need to do anything anyways. Right. That's really the conclusion here. So there you have it. So fun. You know, meanwhile, Tom Wolf, man, not stoked about getting toked. It's a stoking token. It's a token stoking. Not want to kind of become the happy guy.
Can we take a deep breath here?
Yeah. Go for it.
So, recreational marijuana is supported by 2/3 of Pennsylvanians, which means there's a lot of Republicans who support legalizing recreational marijuana.
Exactly.
Governor Wolf says Pennsylvania is not ready for this yet. I don't know why. Who is he placating to this for?
My guess is probably the same voting bloc that thinks that Trump tariffs are good and we might want to kind of think about endorsing Trump in the future. Maybe. I don't know.
But this is just such a no-brainer. New Jersey is going to be on the verge of legalizing it recreationally. They're having those debates right now. What this would do for the criminal justice system would alleviate a lot of stresses that, like, you know, recreational marijuana usage puts on that. It will greatly benefit people of color who are seen to be arrested, like, you know, 9 times out of 10 compared to white people who are caught with marijuana. It's just something we shouldn't be prosecuting people for at this point. I mean, like, alcohol kills a lot of people every year. Marijuana, you cannot die by smoking marijuana. Okay. I mean, we have a state store system in place that we sell, like, stuff that could kill people, alcohol.
Right.
Alcohol kills, you know, people get in alcohol-induced fights and die. People drink too much and die. People get in car crashes from drinking too much and die. other people who don't drink alcohol die because of the people in the cars. Like, this is just something that, like, it's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. And yet Wolf doesn't know what he wants to do on this one.
And then the one thing about, like, this here in Pennsylvania, this became a really popular issue with Eugene T. Pasquale hammering on this for the past year and a half now.
Yep.
And a lot of people in Harrisburg have not liked the fact that he's been doing this, but he's been consistent. He's been saying it over and over again. He's been putting out the numbers, the revenue this will generate, you know, especially with the budget holes that we have. Like, we have the distribution system set up in place right now. We have so much other stuff going on where this is just, it's just a no-brainer. And since DePasquale has been putting this stuff into the news, you see how policy affects people's opinions. Since he's been putting this into the news, the numbers have skyrocketed up to like 60%. The last time this was polled, it was at 60%. It's probably higher than that right now.
There you have it. There you have it. So what seems to be the problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. So still need to study some more? Is that the deal?
I guess.
Yeah, whatever. So meanwhile, about studies that have become concluded, thanks to an 18-month-long investigation by Attorney General Josh Shapiro of several of the Catholic dioceses, right? So the Philadelphia Diocese and I think the Allentown Diocese, right, had already been have been investigated. Right.
Yes. This stuff was investigated back in the 2000s.
Right. So this is the latest report, and now in this is in six dioceses. Over 300 priests are facing allegations. And last night on CBS News, was it last night or just? Let me see if it was last night. Even last night. So there was interviews being conducted by some of the former victims. CBS News's Nikki Batista spoke with several victims who were shared their stories of surviving this abuse for a long period of time. And there were some, I mean, look, I don't like saying this stuff for the sake of saying this stuff, but there were some of those stories where there are people that, you know, they were insistent to say, look, I'm tired of the word abuse. We were raped, right? Talking about kind of a young guy who couldn't walk for a while after and had back problems because of this stuff, right? I mean, we're talking about kids from the age of 10 to 18 who were abused by priests, and there's more than 300 priests facing those kind of allegations, and that report is due to come out any day now. I believe it was October. I'm sorry. August 8th was the soonest. Maybe it was the 7th, the earliest that it could be released. It has not been released yet. There was a report that came out from this this thing called Crux. It's basically reports on the Catholic Church, and said that maybe that. What's that?
This is going to be bigger than the Boston scandal.
Yes. And that's the reason why that the Catholic Church has been fighting this every step of the way to prevent the release of the names.
And not just the Catholic Church has been fighting this. State Senator Stuart Greenleaf is one of the people who have been fighting this, too.
Right here in Bucks County, folks.
Montgomery County, but yes.
I'm sorry. He comes up in Bucks County.
He's retiring this year. His son's probably going to be taking over this seat. And this his legacy after he is out of office should be the fact that he has gone to bat for the Catholic Church so much. He's been pushing bills to change the grand jury laws in Pennsylvania that would hinder the release of these type of reports.
Crazy, man. And this is that, you know, this will be the kind of thing that, you know, is going to blow up in the church in Pennsylvania. And, you know, in my mind, like it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
And Harrisburg has already taken proactive steps. They released 71 names over the past 45 or 50 years. So this is going to be big.
Yes, it will indeed. It will indeed. So we will see if that will be further delayed. Apparently that it has to be released by August 14th, the report, unless there are some additional legal challenges. Apparently there are some of the people that were named in the report have asked for it to be delayed because they didn't have an adequate time to go defend themselves legally or something like this. That's going to be challenging, be pushed back. There's some questions about, is that why this is being delayed? We don't know exactly yet. But it's supposed to be out by August 14th, unless there's some additional challenges that we haven't seen quite yet. So other big news in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So, man. So any anything else addition for in Pennsylvania going on?
I guess we could talk about maybe in the better half.
Maybe in the better half? In the last call?
Last call? Yeah.
All right, we'll talk about the last call.
So I saw Bob Casey the other day.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, we'll talk about that last call. I have to say that, which is good, because, and I don't mean to be rushing, but I know that's okay by you, but
I can hear the dog in the background.
Can you hear? I was gonna say, can you hear the dog barking? I
got his name.
Yeah, I'm gonna Potter is the name. Yes.
Potter. Okay.
Yes, I have two little kids, and so I'm gonna go let my dog out, and I'm gonna bring my dog down for you to meet for the last call, because I think the last call should always include a dog. All right, so we'll come back for the last call in just a minute. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. It's the last call with a little going on today. Yes, indeed. I took a little break. I went upstairs. I got my little pup, and my little pup is down here. Again, his name is Potter. Yes, it is from where you think it's from. Both my kids love Harry Potter, love the whole series, and so they decided on it, and I'm not saying I was outvoted. I'm saying I just didn't vote. I don't know what I said. It was going to be absolutely, it's not going to matter whatsoever.
Gotta leave it up to the kids.
Yes. So I brought him up so Sean could meet him at least online. So yeah, he's down here. He's down here with us now, and hopefully he's only 10 and a half weeks old. And as he kind of, you know, is completely house trained, he's pretty good right now already. But then, he'll be a
now,
regular
are you crate training him or no?
Yeah, well, he was crate trained, right? That's how he's crate trained as a pup. And we have a crate. I've never crate trained a dog before. I had a golden retriever was my last dog, right? And I loved my dog Finnegan. I had he was 16 years old when he finally passed. And it was like, that was right before my son was born, actually. That summer is when he died. And I read stuff about crate training back at that point, or you should sequester off a thing like that. And I'll be honest, I didn't have the freaking heart for it, because like, he would just like cry like you wouldn't believe. And he was a pound puppy and all this stuff. And I couldn't hack it. So, after about the third or fourth night, my bed was pretty much what it's crate turned out to be. But this dog has already, has been crate trained, and I'm going to try to keep some of that, right? He's really good at nighttime. Last night he woke up. We've only had him since Tuesday. So I was like, really good at nighttime. I guess you have to take anything I say about any tendency at this point with a complete grain of salt, because we only had him since Tuesday. But got him from this family. It's this kind of Mennonite family, kind of way up in Schuylkill County. Just kind of, you know, a really sweet dog so far. My kids are absolutely thrilled. They've been lobbying my wife consistently for a year, particularly my son. But my daughter too as well, and they're great with him, and they're super, super happy. And I don't think there has been more than about 45 minutes of video games played since his dog has been here, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So that's my story. That was my big news. Yes, I was up in the Adirondack area and things like this, and I could talk about the beers, but you know what? I just don't have my heart into it. Like, it's a really, I've moved on. I've moved on. So I have to die. The big news, however, Sean.
Well, no, I was going to say, before you get into the big news, I have been experimenting with making old fashions.
Oh, I saw that. I totally meant to text you about that about five times. So old fashions, man. So tell me, what's your preferred recipe so far?
So I like rye whiskey a lot.
Yep.
I've only started drinking whiskey within the past year or so. I never ordered drinks out, mixed drinks before until last year. I've been drinking some old fashions because I'm more of I like the whiskey. Usually what I do is just have a couple shots in a glass and then just maybe an ice cube to open it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, so I went out. I bought a paring knife, a muddler, and some raw sugar cubes. So with the molasses in them and everything.
Yep.
And some bitters. And yeah, I mean, they've been coming out good. I think for me, the thing is how much of ice do I put in it?
Yeah.
For me, it's just one small cube. It's still it's a spicy drink at that point. Still hot from the liquor and all, but it comes out really good. I've been using the orange peel and stuff like that. I've been liking it. Yeah.
Nice, man.
It's just something I wanted to start trying to do, make different drinks and all.
Yeah.
And cocktails and stuff like that, because it's a good alternative to beer.
Hey,
at times.
Alternative, I don't know if you actually call it an alternative. You want to switch it up a little bit, maybe?
But one of the beers I've been drinking a lot lately this summer has been Trogs Sunshine Pils.
Uh-huh.
And that is my favorite Trogs beer. It's just it's a 4.5% German-style Pilsner. And it's on tap at all the bars in Harrisburg. And for $3 and a 20-ounce pint, it's a good deal.
Well, cool. Well, here, I'm going to give you a book recommendation, okay?
Okay.
If you are making cocktails, right, especially if you like old fashions and things like this, the PDT cocktail book.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'll put it in the show notes, right? And so the PDT cocktail book, this is a kind of one of the speakeasies in New York City that kind of spearheaded the revival of kind of old recipes and the kind of the speakeasy environment. I was supposed to go there actually for my birthday last year, and it just didn't kind of pan out the way that the things were that we were working on stuff. But I do. My wife bought me this book a couple years ago, and it's awesome. And basically, what this guy Jim Meehan is the author's name, and he's I think he's the bartender at PDT too as well. It's the kind of place where you actually have to enter through a phone booth in order to get to and shit like this, right? But this what's great about the recipes is that he's got a bunch of these recipes that were from late 1800s and so, or early 20th century, when the whole cocktail thing was really kind of reviving. And a lot of these recipes were just lost, right? So we went around, they kind of gathered up these old recipes and kind of did versions of them to kind of bring back the original American cocktail stuff. And there's phenomenal stuff in there with rye whiskey. Right. I've made a whole bunch of them from this. Definitely, if you get interested in doing that, definitely get that book. The PDT cocktail book, highly recommend it.
Yeah. I've been liking Bullet Rye, which is 95% rye,
mm-hmm.
which is a really spicy rye. I like the Knob Creek rye too. And Michter's has been my favorite, but Michter's is a pretty pricey whiskey. And the Bullet is it's a nice $30 bottle.
Yeah.
I like that spicy taste coming from it that. And I like bourbon too. I was going to try some scotch last night. Uh-huh. I chose not to. It was a $14 shot.
Oh my God.
Lagulin or something like that. out of like it's an Isle Scotch out of Scotland, obviously, but it's like $14 a shot, and I'm just like, I asked the bartender, I was like, which Scotch would you recommend? Well, he's like, Doers is like the intro version, but he's like, I like this one, the Lochgouvlin. I can't pronounce it right. Okay. It's a 15-year Lochgouvlin bottle, and it's like $14. I was like, listen, how much? I was like, I don't want to get like a $20 shot and not like it.
Right.
And Scotch could be like really peaty and stuff like that. So it's something I'm going to be interested in trying, but maybe just take a little small steps at a time.
Have you ever tried Laphroaig?
No.
Like that's Laphroaig or something like this. If you ever want to kind of get yourself, I always say that if you're interested in Scotch at all, you got to try Laphroaig, because what it'll do, it'll set the one end of the continuum, right, in terms of peatiness, because it's like you're like drinking peat smoke, right, in Laphroaig. Right. So it's I love it. I absolutely love that stuff. Like when you're drinking ground and stuff like that. I got introduced to me by my friend Rich, Zumkwala Cook, back in grad school. And I didn't know anything about it, but he's did a bunch of research in Scotland and that kind of stuff. Struck up just kind of a friendship with this guy. He was a bartender and owner of this bar, the Circle Bar in Oxford, Ohio. I can't believe I remember that. In Oxford, Ohio, it was kind of like this like back alley bar. And this guy, we used to go over to Scotland every year and bring back like really cool stuff, right? And so he showed Rich this, and Rich showed me, and blah blah blah. So this is history. So, and yeah. Not to mention, my neighbor is from Scotland, and he has a party kind of like every year the Burns dinner, right? Robbie Burns, like, on his birthday every year, and comes back, so we get to sample new scotches every year. So that's my little thing on Scotch.
Nice.
yeah but cool.
Speaking about
drinking,
I was sitting at the bar the other night,
uh-huh,
Monday, and sit down, you know, and I noticed Senator Casey walked in.
Senator Casey walks into a bar. Ba-doom.
That's the joke.
That's the joke, right?
But no, he had a nice sit down with some of the Capitol press.
Uh-huh.
Just having an off-the-record conversation, conversing about stuff. And it's pretty cool to see that, be exposed to that, being in Harrisburg on the ground out here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty interesting. It was like I can't really go into the details of the conversations that was had, obviously, because I so wanted to crash the event.
Uh-huh.
Because like, I knew the people who were putting it on, uh-huh, were all Capitol Press Room journalists. So it would have been like odd if I just walked up and just decided to sit down with them, because like, are they going to kick me out or not?
Yeah, that would have been interesting on its own.
No, they had a really good conversation out. They actually were really impressed with it afterwards. A couple of the journalists knew him for like 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the first time they ever really got to sit down and talk to him.
Oh, that's cool.
And he just got to show his personal side. So, I mean, that's pretty cool. Like, you get to see that stuff out here in Harrisburg happening on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Not on a regular basis, but you get to
see.
Sounds
like the kind of thing that you could write a fluff piece about if you wanted to, right? I used to think this about Bob Casey, but then I sat down and had a drink with him, and he turned out to be a really nice guy.
But like, the institutional experience, like, you can learn from someone like that, which is pretty cool. I mean,
yeah, long-term political family was kind of, you know, keeping control over the reins of power. No, I'm just joking with you.
Well, supposedly he's a lot more mild-mannered than his dad.
Oh, is that the case?
Everyone, supposedly, like, you would hear stories, but like, how everyone, his dad, no one really liked him that much because he was just personality wise not that great of a person. But supposedly, like, everyone likes Casey, and he actually like walked in with a smile on his face and all. He wasn't stone faced.
Well, I have to say, I mean, you and I were talking about this yesterday, but it's like, I think that Casey, I've got, I'll give him credit.
He's moving with the winds of the party.
Yes, and I give him credit. That's exactly what I'll give him credit for. And, you know, I mean, he has had the reputation as a centrist, even conservative Democrat, especially when it comes to kind of women's health issues and abortion rights and things like this. But, you know, he does not seem to want to be the guy who's going to be, like, standing in the way of the movement of the party to the left. And that is encouraging. And that's something that, you know, I'll give him kudos for that. That doesn't mean that now he's become the hero in my book. I just want to be clear about that. But it does speak to kind of a character that I think is what I wish I'd see more, especially in, you know, more long-term
established politics. After Trump got elected, he could have ran to the center with his job being on the line this year. And instead, decided to go with the winds of the party and move further to the left on some key issues.
Yeah, good for him.
Still needs to move there. Still has to be there with women's reproductive rights. But
yep. No, exactly. I mean, as you've always said, like, that really should be kind of one of the kind of the litmus tests, right? I mean, here's your baseline. And, you know, again, he hasn't. Well, I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not going to try to say one thing or another. He needs to be there. Period.
Yeah,
that's it. What was I going to say? Oh, so before we get to the big news, just want to say a quick thing is that for those of you who tuned into our last kind of mega issue of our episode of Free Range, the Free Range podcast with Colleen Fitzgerald, Colleen and I are kind of starting to move towards the release of our next episode, which is pretty cool. Now that I'm a little bit settled in and not going to be bouncing around from one place to another, visiting family and that kind of thing, I can focus back on that. So look for that maybe next week. We'll see. I'll kind of keep you posted. If you tuned into our last episode, yes, you'll know I broke it up into two segments. All right. So if you wanted the full, basically 3-hour version of the podcast, you could listen to that whole thing, right? You got a whole long ride that you wanted to deal with that. Frankly, it was so characteristic of the kind of conversations that Colleen and I have, right? And you know, she had a good way of putting it. She was like, look, she's like, you know, some people like 5-hour dinners and some people don't. She's like, I'm a person who likes 5-hour dinners. I like to be able to sit down, eat good food, talk with people, have conversations to see where they go. And, you know, if people don't like it, well, I don't know what to tell them. Right? So I was like, okay, I can get behind that. Right. Not that, you know, as Sean knows, I can go on. I can talk. Right. about different stuff. And so we kind of get into stuff that, you know, went from, you know, philosophy to politics to community to food to farms to, you know, a whole bunch of kind of really cool stuff. But I did release it also as part one and part two. So if you wanted it broken up in chunks. And one of the things that I've been thinking about talking about with Colleen about says, hey, you know what, if we actually have a session that goes real long, maybe we could just release it like that right from the get-go, right? As part one and part two is two separate podcasts, even if they come out kind of at the same time. It might be kind of cool. But, you know, we're getting some feedback from people from Free Range. And for the most part, really, really positive stuff. It's been remarkable to see Free Range take off in the way that it has. We've got some cool stuff planning. Our first round of interviews and on-site interviews with people like with farmers and bakers and distillers and things like this are coming up, where Colleen and I are actually going to locations, record on location for these places. That stuff is going to be coming your way too as well. It's really exciting. There's one piece of news that I'm going to hold off on that before I got to talk to Colleen about this, because I found some possible really cool possibilities about funding stuff, but I'm not going to say any more about that. Oh, cool. So there's that. So look for Free Range coming up. And now, the big news, Sean.
We are going to Netroots Nation 2019.
Netroots Nation! That's right.
We went to Providence, Rhode Island like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, God, 6 years ago. It was a long time ago.
And, you know, it's a very hefty expense to go to this, but Netroots Nation is coming to Philadelphia next year, 2019. It's going to be one of the most important, like, political years. This is when people are going to be testing the waters to run for.
Yes, and they will be saying waters
for their political run. And, man, It's going to be hit right here in Philly.
Right in Philadelphia. And Helen Jim actually made the announcement, which was freaking awesome.
And
the way that I have to say, the way that she contextualized it too as well is why this is so important. Because one of the big criticisms over the years of Netroots Nations is that it's primarily kind of white progressives, right? This, we saw this in the Bernie Sanders campaign where Black Lives Matters kind of like pushback with Sanders like on there. There was this big thing.
DSA, even though the DSA members have been electing women of color to office and stuff like that.
Exactly. And they said people who longtime attendees of Netroots Nations, it just took place in New Orleans, if you haven't been following, just took place in New Orleans, a long time attendees said this was the most diverse crowd that they have had, right? And Netroots Nation. And then you have the folks, kind of the younger, especially the younger kind of people of color that are coming in, basically being like, man, this place is still white, which is like the best possible response, right? Because it says that you got this energy coming in, and even though it's the most diverse, it's nowhere near where like the country is going to look here. And what Helen Jim did is she basically laid it out in terms of anti-racism, about anti-racist politics of a long tradition of that in Philadelphia, about the immigrant struggles that are going on there, about the pushback in public education. When she made the announcement at Netroots in New Orleans that it was going to be in Philadelphia, that was awesome. And yes, we are going.
Yes. I mean, also, you look at the way she said it, the pushback against public education, the pushback Occupy ICE that had a really big victory a couple weeks ago. They got Kenny to end the Parks agreement with ICE, where there's going to be no more data sharing. I mean, Philadelphia has become a lot more of a progressive city over the past 10 years than it has, like, more than that, just traditional machine-led Democratic type city.
No, actually, but I would say actually what's interesting about Philadelphia has a long radical tradition, right?
Rizzo.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about like if you go back to like the global justice movement back in, back in 1999, 2000, Philadelphia was one of the first independent media centers that was set up and went in the west side of Philadelphia as part of the anarchist community that's rooted there, who has long history of in West Philadelphia, right? The anarchist community there. They were known when I was in college, right? This is back in the early 90s. That part of Philadelphia was known as part of kind of like an anarchist haven. They have like
the Media Mobilizing Project is big down there.
The Media Mobilizing Project, right? Again, they're doing absolutely amazing work in Philadelphia, like Philly Student Power, the kind of walkouts that they were doing in that history. Also in Philadelphia, look, if you go back way back, right, that's where the Children's March took place with Mother Jones, like marched from Philadelphia, the textile mills in Kensington, right? Out to President, was it Roosevelt? Roosevelt's Long Island kind of like compound or whatever like this, right? Basically drawing attention to the issues of child labor.
One of the things got me looking into this. I don't know if we talked about this. So I grew up in the Juniata Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
One of the housing projects, the affordable housing apartments complexes, is named after Carl Mackley. And Carl Mackley was from my neighborhood. Back in 1920, he was killed by a strikebreaker, and he's like 19 years old. His funeral, he worked from a textile mill, brought out 40,000 people in Kensington to go to his funeral.
Yep.
Like, it was one of the largest mass gatherings in the city's history. Like, I mean, there's that rooted labor history in Philadelphia that people really don't talk about.
You know what's ironic about that labor history in Philadelphia, right? Because I know that there's sections of the labor movement in Philadelphia that get the bad rap of, you know, being kind of like anti-immigrant, kind of like borderline racist, right, and things like this. And that is a very, very kind of warped vision of labor in Philadelphia. You know, so I mean, that we're also talking about like SEIU in Philadelphia. We're talking, which basically carries on and remembers every time that I've been at something where SEIU has been at, or UFCW for that matter, or if you're
the airport worker strikes, it's been going on.
The airport worker strike. They talk about that history, right? They talk about that history and draw from that kind of those kind of traditions.
And they always say Philly's a union town, like
totally
every. Every time someone says that, like, you are not welcome in our city because we are a union city.
Right.
And no, I mean, like, this is going to be fun. This is going to be any presidential candidate who wants to run in 2019, 2020 is going to be coming through here. It's between Philadelphia and New York, or it's between New York and DC. It's going to be easy for people to get to. We're already talking about this media wise out here in Harrisburg. I mean, we're like, there's already people like it's. I mean, also you look at the attention that Sarah Namorado, Summer Lee, and Fiedler have been getting. I mean, it's going to be a fun event. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh man, I can't wait. I just can't wait, and it's going to be so much. And I'm actually like, I know I grew up. Well, you know, I know very little about the like Philadelphia music scene, other wow. than what I, you know, learned through Philly ska. Right? I remember like in, again, late 80s, early 90s, Philadelphia was, it still is, right? But as a hotbed of ska, especially anti-racist ska, coming out of there. And I'm interested in the music and the political music that's going to come out of Philly. I'm interested in kind of meeting it's people still, from across the country.
I feel like there's a punk revival going on in Philadelphia right now, yep. too. A lot of the bands I listen to they're from like Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, but they all moved to Philadelphia, and that's where they're based out of right now. You know, more of your emo pop punk stuff, not like the political oriented music, but it's still that hotbed for music. Yep. It's still a hotbed for art and, you know, culture. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to have to stay downtown, obviously.
We have to find a way. Yeah, I mean, it's like so here's what we did. So I'm going to tell everybody right now, very like early, right? So this is one of the things that, you know, like I always put aside money like for myself, right? For Raging Chicken is to do this kind of stuff, right? So to make sure that, you know, we are slowly building, you know, what we do, and we're there for these events, and we can kind of network and think about how we do things better, hopefully connect up with other people that you know, we can bring into this project, and we can help support their project, build alliances and connections, all sorts of stuff like that. And that's what I really hope to do too as well. So right now, right in that kind of let's call it a travel fund, right? that I built up enough because we knew this was going to be coming around. I had no idea it's coming to Philadelphia, but knew that, you know, we wanted to do something here. Sean and I have talked, you know, about getting to Netroots for the past few years, but it's been too much of a haul. Like, you know, it's one thing to pay, you know, to pay the admission and that kind of stuff. It's a whole other thing.
Airfare, you know, or like we can't drive to New Orleans and stuff like that.
Right. Exactly. But so here's the biggest pitch I want to make to everybody out there now is know this, is that Sean and I are definitely going, right? So we're already locked in for that. And as we move forward, I mean, I don't know what our team of writers is going to look like as we you know, get towards Netroots Nation next year. But we would like to bring as many people as possible forward. So we're probably going to be doing some fundraising to try to help raise some funds to get our crew there, because we want to. I think Netroots is going to be so important for exactly the reasons that Sean laid out. Like ahead of 2020, this is going to be absolutely huge. Like as an activist kind of center, as a media center for progressive politics, it's going to happen right here in Philadelphia. So I'm just absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, yeah, I can't wait. I know I'm going to be renting camera equipment for this. I'm not just going to be using my dinky lens that I have on my camera. I'm going to rent out for the weekend. It'll probably cost me $100, but I'll just rent out a nice 70-200, like the lens I took to the Sanders rally. I'll rent that again. And then I'm going to rent probably a nice, like, fast 35mm prime lens.
There you go.
Yeah. So
there you go. Nice. So, you know, if you think about it right now, again, this is another pitch. Yes, become a member of Raging Chicken Press. Little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/RCPress. We'll start when we kind of start getting close. Probably not going to be until 2019, right? Until after January or so, before we really start kind of pushing on the fundraising stuff for this. Probably actually the end of this year, so that, you know, as people start doing their Giving Tuesday stuff and everything, getting ready for you know, make your end of the year donation stuff, keep Raging Chicken Press in mind. We will have multiple ways for you to kind of donate to this to help kind of bring us all there in Philadelphia. The more support,
I'll sell some artwork if I need.
Yeah, there you go. We go. Seriously. And we'll have, you know, Sean will sell artwork. I'll send you books. I mean, we'll have a bunch of stuff that we can do. So you're not getting my puppy, though. No, you're not getting my puppy. Oh, man. Anything else good of the order, Sean?
That's it. I'm excited.
That's it. Well, hey, if everything still pans out, if for this weekend and the weather actually does break and we actually get a nice weekend, have an awesome weekend. If for whatever reason we get another stalled front and then all the crap weather starts to keep staying here. Yeah.
Oh, man, the last few days were brutal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been nasty. It's been nasty. So, yeah, chin up and move on.
This is going to, like, break. It's going to be, like, in the upper 70s, low 80s for the next 15 days, starting on Sunday. And I'm like, I'm getting to that point. Do I want to take the AC unit out of my window?
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to be careful because you never know what's going
to
happen.
The Earth moves closer to the sun every year. We have more people. You know, humans have warm bodies. So is heat coming off?
What are you
going to
do?
We're going through a lot of change, but I think
a lot of change,
we
Sean.
Are, as a society, doing the best we can.
Doing the best we can, and we're going to keep on doing the best we can. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, talking to you, as always, with Sean Kitchen, our muckraker-in-chief out there in Harrisburg. This has been Out the Coop Podcast. We look forward to talking to you next week. See ya!